Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour has written a fascinating book that not only looks at 33 protest songs from many years ago to now, he also looks at the history of the times because, of course, protest songs address political issues of their times. The book is 33 Revolutions Per Minute, a history of protest songs from Billie Holiday to Green Day. And our guest is Dorian Linsky. Dorian is a music writer for The Guardian who also writes for Q, The Word, and Spin, among many other publications. This is his first book. And he says he uses the term protest songs in its broadest sense, to describe a song which addresses a political issue in a way which aligns itself with the underdog. In many ways, writing a protest song, he says, is asking for trouble, and it's this sense of jeopardy which gives the form its vitality. The songs in this book, and he examines 33 of them, we'll hear as many as we can, tend to stem from concern, anger, doubt, and in practically every case, sincere emotion. We will look at the books, the songs that he has included, and they include Billie Holiday, a song from Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, Bob Dylan, Nina Simone, Country Joe and the Fish, James Brown, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Gil Scott-Heron, who died recently, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, Stevie Wonder, Carl Bean, U2, and many others, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls as well. I'm sure there are songs that you consider protest songs that you think were meaningful, important. What are your thoughts on what those songs might be? Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address here is talk@wpr.org. Dorian lives in England. He joins us by phone from London today. Hi, Dorian.
Oh, hi there. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Yeah, thanks very much for being with us. For a while, we thought, and I'm a child of the 1960s, that pop music could change the world, that protest music could change the world. Of the 33 songs you include in this book, is it fair to say that most of these songs, people who listened to them or people who wrote them, thought they would change the world, or did they just want to write a good song?
I think it certainly changes over time. You know that in the 60s there was much more expectation from artists. I mean, because rock music was evolving at such a pace and was so exciting, and you know, youth culture was changing. There were so many political flashpoints that it seemed, you know, to certain people it seemed illogical that these artists would sort of step up and you know, lead the revolution. I'm not sure whether the artists themselves always did. I mean, what surprised me when I was doing the research was how many people actually had quite humble motives. You know, Bob Dylan never spoke grandly about what he was trying to achieve with his protest songs. Neil Young was very modest about Ohio. So I wonder whether it was actually more fans and activists that had this expectation, and that musicians were a little more aware of their limits, you know, and what an artist could do, which is to raise an issue, to ask a question, but not necessarily to lead a movement.
I like Joan Baez's statement here. I hate protest songs, but some songs do make themselves clear.
Yeah, what intrigued me was that, you know, going back to the early 60s, the phrase protest song was very loaded and people distanced themselves from it. Baez, Bob Dylan, Barry McGuire, who sang Eve of Destruction. And I thought, wow, you know, even in what we think of as the heyday of protest songs, people were wary of the expectations that came with it, wary of being held against a standard that they couldn't help to meet. So, you know, that's why I've tried to sort of, you know, destigmatize the phrase a little in the book and say, look, there are lots of different ways you can discuss politics. It doesn't mean that you are in a box and that you can only do that one thing, or that you are somehow expected to change society overnight.
Let's start with the first song that you include in this book. And this song, every time I hear it, it just haunts me. I did not know the background of this song, so if you would please tell us who wrote it and how it came to be Billie Holiday's song, Strange Fruit.
Well, it was written in, I forget whether it was 36 or 37, by a Jewish school teacher called Abel Meeropol, who wrote under a Gentile name of Lewis Allen and was a member of the Communist Party. And he had been very moved by a picture of a lynching that he'd seen in a magazine. A lynching took place in 1930. And he wrote this song, and it was kind of passed around, you know, Communist Party activist circles, and other people sang it. But it was only when it reached Billie Holiday, and she was, there's some dispute over whether she needed some persuading or whether she loved it right away, it then entered this whole other sphere where there were people going to see her perform who were not members of a political party, who did not, were not thinking about politics every day. And that's when it became something different, and that's the story of the book, really, about how politics can enter the arena of pop music and people who are not necessarily confronted with these issues. And what Billie Holiday does to the song in her phrasing, in the emotion of the delivery, in the arrangement that her band members put together, is turns it into a story. It's not preaching. It's a story. It's moving. It's very much about one woman's, you know, pain and interpretation of pain. And the transformation of that song from what it was on the page to what it is in that record is astonishing and is a real watershed.
And we'll talk about how audiences responded to it when she sang. First, we'll hear a little bit of, Billie Holiday and Strange Fruit.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Billie Holiday and Strange Fruit. Tell me about how black audiences and how white audiences may have differed in their response to this song.
It was very complicated, you know. It had, you know, divided black listeners and divided white listeners. But certainly there were some black listeners who felt that this was not what they wanted to hear on a night out, that this was not fit subject for entertainment, even though obviously this was an issue which concerned them, you know, very much. I mean, because of that, they felt like, look, we think about racism all the time, and now we've just come out to enjoy ourselves. And at the same time, it was picked up and adored by, you know, left-wing progressives, some of them black, but many of them white as well, that sort of felt that, well, this is what black music should be doing. This is what a black artist should be doing. And it did create a certain tension, and something that has gone on through the decades, which is that white listeners, particularly sort of progressive white listeners, sometimes think that, that black music is nobler when it addresses these issues. You see that going through soul and disco and hip-hop, and that there's almost a moral hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's interesting is that some of these black listeners in 1939 were aware of that problem, were aware that they didn't want to be expected to be noble and earnest and political every day of their lives.
Did radio stations play this song?
Not very much, no. It sort of spread through other means. I mean, it would have been played in certain places, not at all in the South. And, you know, it's a pretty, you know, it's a slow, haunting, menacing song. You know, even if you don't listen to the lyrics, it's not necessarily radio fodder. And so it spread through unusual means, you know, that sort of literary magazines would pick up on it and reprint the lyrics. Politicians would embrace it. It moved through those channels rather than the mainstream pop ones.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, somebody gives this, the owner of the Harlem Apollo, you write, said when she wrenched the final words from her lips, there was not a soul in the audience, black or white, who did not feel half strangled. That's quite a description of a song.
Yeah, and in fact, there's quite a few other descriptions of the song which use that language of violence, of strangling people, of burning them, of searing them, of ripping their guts out. And, you know, it does take you back to that you know, that moment of thinking of this was not what people sang about. This was not what you heard. When you put a record on the player, and it really did shock people. You know, it's very hard to imagine quite how dramatic and shocking that experience would have been at that time.
Mm-hmm. I love your final words in the description of Strange Fruit in your book. Her mother asked, when she first began singing this song, "Why are you sticking your neck out?" "Because it might make things better," Billy replied. Her mother says, "But you'll be dead." Her response, "Yeah, but I'll feel it. I'll know it in my grave."
Yeah, I think it's a tremendously moving, powerful quote, that sense of risk, which I think it runs through so many artists in the book, that this is often a very painful, difficult thing to do, to take on a protest song, not just in terms of the flack that you might get from radio stations or listeners or people that don't like your politics, but also the emotional toll it takes on you. You know, she really did, she carried that song with her the rest of her life and didn't always perform it. Sometimes she thought, this audience does not deserve it. What I need to put myself through in order to sing this has to be the right audience.
Our guest this hour is the author of 33 Revolutions Per Minute, a history of protest songs from Billie Holiday to Green Day. Dorian Lynskey is our guest, a man with a fascinating history who was hugely important to many folk singers after him. We'll listen to a little bit. You'll know who it is. We'll listen to a little bit of his defining song. And we'll welcome phone calls as well. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email address is talk@wpr.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, and I saw above me that endless skyway, I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
Woody Guthrie and This Land Is Your Land. What an interesting character and what an influential performer he was in terms of inspiring so many performers who followed him.
Yeah, he was kind of the first really star protest singer that, before, there was a tradition in protest singing that the song was what was important, not the performer. Pete Seeger, who was younger than Woody, but he represented that tradition that you're really just there to disseminate the song, to get people singing along, and then you can kind of always step out of the way. Whereas Woody was such a creative, charismatic, problematic, inspirational character that he became a kind of hero, an iconic figure in his own right. And that was what inspired, not just Bob Dylan, who's the obvious one, but the people further down the line, like Joe Strummer, from The Clash, who used to call himself Woody.
And tell us a bit about his life, who his influences were. He was kind of a self-made intellectual, what he read, how he bummed around the country. He was just a very, very compelling, had a very compelling personal story.
Yeah, his mum had Huntington's disease, which sort of eroded her sanity, and there was a tragic incident where she was held herself responsible for an accident in which Woody's sister set fire to herself and died. And his dad had great ambitions, named Woody after Woodrow Wilson. And his ambitions didn't really come to much, and he ended up, his business failed. And Woody became this kind of early bohemian. He was reading like Khalil Gibran and kind of, doing yoga and just voraciously reading all this kind of stuff, which he then downplayed, because when his career started, he realized that people wanted somebody who represented the Okies from the Dust Bowl, an ordinary son of the soil kind of blue collar guy, and he really downplayed all of that, you know, fancy cultural learning he'd been doing, and sort of channeled his poetry into this very populist demotic form, and really tried to make himself, really tried to provide a different vision of America, you know, a progressive vision of America, which is why This Land Is Your Land is the song that I chose. And lots of people, obviously Americans who had grown up with it, would not necessarily think of it as a political song. But to him, it was his vision of America, that when he fled the Dust Bowl and traveled to Los Angeles, he noticed that a lot of immigrants were being turned away on the highway by armed policemen from the LAPD. So he realized that, you know, they were not all in it together, that he became very class conscious, and he became very aware that there were bits of the country that were sort of shut off to the common man. And so when he wrote This Land Is Your Land as a kind of retort to God Bless America, there were all these kind of political meanings that were not always obvious, but they were encoded in the lines. That was the point he was trying to make.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of songs and what were his political views when it came to World War II?
Very complicated, because he never joined the Communist Party, but he definitely followed the party line during the 30s. And because of the Nazi-Soviet pact, which lasted up to 41, there was, you know, the American communists would, even though they didn't like Hitler, would kind of, you know, would sort of oppose the war and oppose U.S. intervention. And then when Hitler invaded Russia, all of that changed, and suddenly they were like, basically writing pro-war songs. And that's where This Machine Kills Fascists comes from. You know, he meant fascists as in very specifically the German Nazis. And it's one of those just uncomfortable kind of moments where you look back and think, you know, how could he have backed Stalin so strongly in the 30s? But, you know, a lot of American communists back then didn't really know fully what Stalin was up to, and his was very much a learning process, mm-hmm. and he'd never minded. He would make a joke of the fact that he had changed his mind and that he sort of found a different way of looking at things.
And why was it Woody Guthrie that so captivated Bob Dylan? He went to meet with him. He was a huge influence on the way even Dylan presented himself.
Well, he was a very romantic figure. You know, he was kind of vagabond. He moved around. When he got popular, he'd get like a radio show in LA and then later in New York, and loads of fan mail and a good wage. And then after a while, he'd offend somebody and resign and go traveling again. He was always sort of wandering around the country. And when Bob Dylan was trying to remake himself, that was a really intoxicating idea, the sort of man with no past, or the man with, you know, apparently no past, who Yeah, and combined being a kind of bohemian poet with being an ordinary, you know, solid American. And plus, you know, these were songs that there was a huge catalogue of songs that Woody produced. And for any musician, that was pretty inspiring.
We continue our conversation with Dorian Lynskey, author of 33 Revolutions Per Minute, a history of protest songs from Billie Holiday to Green Day. We welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dorian Lynskey is our guest. The book is 33 Revolutions Per Minute, a history of protest songs from Billie Holiday to Green Day. And we have lines open for you if you'd like to join the conversation. An email has come in. Has Dorian ever heard of Hasta Siempre, Comandante, or simply Hasta Siempre, a 1965 Spanish song by Cuban composer Carlos Puebla? The song's lyrics are a reply to revolutionary Che Guevara's farewell letter when he left Cuba.
No, I'm ashamed to say I haven't. I've come across thousands, but no, not that one. And it sounds fascinating. I'll have to look it up now.
And we're just concentrating mostly on the songs that were American songs because there are so many of them. You also include other songs from the West, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's in order to narrow the scope a little bit. I mean, it's a big book, and so I made it fairly Anglo-American in its scope. And then I felt obviously needed to reach out to Jamaica for 70s reggae, Nigeria for Fela Kuti, and then Latin America for Victor Jara, the Chilean folk singer, and people from Argentina and Brazil as well, because I felt that they had an important role in the story of you know, protest music in general. But there's a whole world out there, and if you asked people from all over the world, they would have their own, I think, protest song heroes that have not made an impact on, say, the American imagination.
Weren't you amazed? I was so amazed as I was reading the book, and it is a very big book. When you take 33 songs and talk about their importance, how much of the history of the time, it's almost as though you wrote a history book, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it was kind of, that's how it evolved. I wanted to, you know, I did set myself this task of, I want to explain these songs, you know, give people all the information they need to understand these songs. And in a lot of cases, you have to pan back a long way, that if you want to understand, for example, what you're saying about Woody and This Land Is Your Land, you know, you have to talk about what the state of the American left in the 1930s. If you want to talk about Stevie Wonder's Living for the City, you have to talk about, you know, what it was like in New York in the 70s and, you know, housing conditions and things like that. And so pretty soon I realized that it was, you know, kind of going to be a narrative history of, I suppose, you know, of counterculture, of rebellion, of elections. It was the kind of book that I would have really needed and loved when I was 17 and getting into both politics and music very strongly, but not always knowing the coordinates, not understanding the context. When I heard The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, I heard Public Enemies Fight the Power, there was so much that I didn't know about why those records came about the way they did. So, yeah, I mean, I would love it to be read as a history of obviously far more than those 33 songs.
You've written a couple protest songs, too, I read.
Oh, yeah, but they were very bad and clumsy. And I kind of realized that this was when I was about 18, and I realized that, you know, you do have to have, you can't just have the political knowledge and the passion. You know, you do have to have some songwriting ability, because that's how you turn something which otherwise is merely sort of bad propaganda into art, and which can contain ambiguity or move the listener and do all the things that a song should do. And because of that experience, it gave me maybe increased respect for all of these songs that were done so well, knowing how easy it is to do them badly.
Let's go to phone calls. Marissa in Menominee. Hi, Marissa.
Yes, hi. It's actually Martha, but that's okay.
Okay, hi, Martha.
Hi. Say, I'm thinking Woodstock, Joni Mitchell, and Rich Man's War, but I think the one that does it for me, never fails, is Neil Young's Ohio. Every time I hear those opening chords, it just takes me right back to the 70s, and I think Neil Young just nailed it with hitting it right on the head with the feeling that, you know, that was generated by the massacre at Kent State. And, it, you know, I'm 50 now, and every time I hear that song, it just takes me right back.
Well, we'll take you back for a moment and then hear the background of this song.
Done long ago. What did you do?
That's one of the songs that's included in the book, 33 Revolutions Per Minute. Neil Young wrote that, Ohio, and it was written in and recorded in rapid order, wasn't it? I was amazed at the background of that story.
Yeah, he wrote it in a couple of hours when David Crosby showed him the copy of Life magazine with the shots from Kent State. And then, you know, they flew down either that day or the next to record it. And then it was out within a week, which, you know, at that time was quite an achievement. You know, the record label really pulled out the stops. And what I love so much about that record is that you feel that outpouring of emotion. You know, the lyrics are very good, but they're quite minimal. He doesn't attempt to, in the old folk tradition, it's not the ballad of Kent State. He doesn't attempt to tell people that don't know what happened. He just expresses the emotion, the sense that, you know, there was a kind of you know, generational civil war in America, and it happened at a, you know, at such a volatile, dramatic time when a lot of the rhetoric at the time was that, you know, this was going to get a lot worse. There were going to be more like this. There was maybe going to be, you know, some form of revolution. There was a lot of very heated debate and a huge divide between middle America and the youth. And even though Neil Young was a, you know, fairly rich celebrity at this stage, and so not quite the same as, you know, a student activist, mm-hmm. he was representing, you know, trying to represent that sense of frustration and anguish and doubt. And, you know, when he goes, "This summer I hear the drumming," and this came out in May, in the month of Kent State, and there was this real uncertainty about what was going to happen that summer. Was it going to be, you know, this bloody, dramatic, violent summer?
It is amazing, Martha, when you hear this song, and I feel the same way about Strange Fruit and some of the other songs that we'll hear, that they are written about these absolutely horrific events, and that you listen to them and you feel some of the horror of the event, and that you can still hear it now, and I do as well, so many years after the event.
Yeah, you know, just listening to your clip there, it just brought tears to my eyes. Now that I'm a parent, the parent's worst nightmare, you know, your child's going off to college and getting the news of that terrible tragedy, and it gives me a new perspective on the song, but it's always been an emotional song for me. I'll never forget hearing that song.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Mike in Wauwatosa. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen. The song Strange Fruit brought up something that happened over the weekend, and I never realized this, but singing our Memorial Day observance, the song "Oh Beautiful for Spacious Skies," a lot of Europeans realized that there was a genocide in this country against Native Americans starting in 1492. And when I listened to the words of that song, it just hit me as if I were Native American, I would be absolutely, you know, it basically just continues the racism against that atrocity as well. And I know there's nothing going back to protest songs to 1492, but what happened in this country was truly a genocide, not just against the blacks, but also the Native Americans.
Dorian?
Well, I mean, that was partly, you know, what was going on, what I was saying earlier with "This Land Is Your Land," was that there were, you know, there's a tradition in, you know, certain patriotic songs in America, some of which started out as, if not protest songs, political songs, you know, the revolutionary songs. And obviously there are parts of that history that have been, you know, that are certainly not parts of American history that are not contained in those songs. And in the 70s, you saw a lot of people, Gil Scott-Heron, the Temptations, the Steve Miller Band, mentioning Native Americans, either in the context of the original genocide or in terms of how they were living at that time, you know, in reservations and poverty. So I think sometimes you can get that certain protest songs are actually responses to existing songs, you know, that these songs end up having almost an argument between themselves.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's talk a little bit about James Brown and Hubert Humphrey, of all people, right after we hear a song that we will forever think of James Brown. We will think of him when we hear this song. James Brown, I'm Black and I'm Proud, included in the book. Soul Power Meets Black Power is the name of this chapter, and an interesting intro to the chapter. On the evening of August 7, 1968, James Brown was in his hotel room in Hollywood when he heard a knock on the door. When he opened it and peered out, the corridor was empty, but whoever had knocked had left behind a package demanding his attention. Squatting malignantly on the carpet was a deactivated hand grenade with the word James Brown painted on it. And thus begins the story about James Brown, which is fascinating. Dorian, please tell us.
Well, James Brown was a very problematic character in the sense that he was... His vision of black power was black capitalism, essentially. It was, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. He was not really into radical rhetoric, and he thought that he was, a good example. He was doing good work. But when you had black power and people like Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown and the Black Panthers coming through with a much more militant, much more left-wing agenda, he was really torn, and people were calling him Uncle Tom, and this song was his response. The grenade was kind of, he never knew who left it, but he assumed it was the same people who were, attacking him for not being black enough. And that this song was, as far as I could tell, a kind of rather reluctant statement. I mean, it didn't sound reluctant in the least, and he certainly was proud to be black. But it was a more political statement than he really wanted to make. And, he became quite cozy with Hubert Humphrey. Later on, when Nixon beat Humphrey, he became very friendly with Nixon, which outraged people even more. So this song is kind of came out of this particular moment and it made him seem far more sort of radical and militant than he really felt in his bones.
There's a wonderful picture, and I never knew this story before, of if you just look at his face, James Brown with Hubert Humphrey at a rally that I believe took place in Watts.
Mm. Yeah, well, Humphrey, I mean, James Brown said that he would have backed Bobby Kennedy until Bobby Kennedy was shot, but kind of agreed to help Humphrey. He'd visited the White House before and... agree to kind of to stand with him. But at that rally, he realized that, that Humphrey didn't really have what it took. He tried to sort of press his own agenda on him. And he wanted to be, he liked being around power. That was the thing with James Brown. He liked feeling that he had political influence. And like a lot of musicians, they find out that the politicians have more power and are smarter and more manipulative, and that people would use him for certain things. And it's not that he was not a powerful figure. When Martin Luther King was shot, James Brown's appearance in Boston, Boston was one of the few major American cities which didn't experience a riot that night. He did have this command over people, but not as much as I think he fancied when he had the ear of Humphrey or Nixon.
Mm-hmm. We will hear some Nina Simone, also from the civil rights movement, and a song that she wrote remembering Sunday, September 15th, 1963, and how she responded to the news that morning at 10:19 that over a dozen sticks of dynamite had detonated in the basement of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. This song came pouring out, and we'll hear it in a moment. And take more phone calls. Our guest this hour is Dorian Linsky. He's the author of 33 Revolutions Per Minute, a history of protest songs from Billie Holiday to Green Day. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
But that's just the trouble. Washing the window. Everybody knows about Mississippi. God damn.
A song that came, as you write, a rush of fury, hatred, and determination. Her response, which you write about so dramatically in the Nina Simone Mississippi Goddamn 1964 chapter, she was really, and it was a defining song of 1964, wasn't it, Dorian?
Yeah, it was just, there was nothing that angry before in in black pop music. It was, Strange Fruit was obviously more mournful, and there were certainly protest voices in black music. But this was so furious, and it kind of took people by surprise. She wrote it much like Neil Young wrote Ohio, in this kind of blast of grief and fury. And then she performed it the following year. And what you can hear in the live versions, because there isn't a studio version, there's only live versions, is the audience not really knowing what to make of it. And it starts off quite jaunty, and she seems to be making a joke at the beginning. And then the song gets more and more frantic, more and more properly furious, singling out America, saying this whole country is full of lies, which is an incredibly dramatic thing for somebody to be saying in 1964. And it just, you can hear the audience being absolutely shaken as she builds and builds and builds the intensity. And it kind of looked ahead to, the same year Sam Cooke made Change Is Gonna Come, and I like to think of those two songs as, one is very much the, looking at something painful and making it into something sort of benign and healing and hopeful and sort of gospel-influenced. And then hers was just the pure rage, and that goes on. And, I can hear traces of Mississippi Goddamn in hip-hop. In angry records from decades later. It's a real watershed record.
And we're going to hear some Sam Cooke at the end of this show, because the book starts with the inauguration of Barack Obama, who makes reference to this song. And it's a marvelous song, I think, so we'll hold off until the end to hear that. Let's go to the chapter. Carl Bean, I Was Born This Way, 1977, Gay Pride and the Hidden Politics of Disco. What are the hidden politics of disco?
Well, disco got perceived at the time by many people, and was perceived for years afterwards, as a kind of betrayal, as just vapid party music, and that it came at the end of an incredibly socially conscious period in soul music, with What's Going On and Stevie Wonder and Curtis Mayfield and so many records like that. And disco was seen as like, oh, let's not worry, let's just party. But it came out of a very oppressed minority, the gay scene at the dawn of gay rights, and particularly the black gay scene, which was a minority within a minority. And a lot of this was sort of encoded in the music, that the music was defiant, the celebration was often tinged with kind of melancholy and doubt. And we're not talking here about, Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. With Carl Bean, that was the first record to make that, to put that completely front and center. I'm happy, I'm gay, I was born this way. And to take all of those sort of hidden politics and just put it out there. And it wasn't a hit as a result, but it was a huge anthem in the gay clubs and a very brave statement at that time. And, of course, Lady Gaga, pretty much the biggest pop record of this year, has taken inspiration from that, taken her title from Carl Bean's song, and, retwisted that to apply to a different situation now.
Which version should I play? I have both, Carl Bean or Lady Gaga.
Carl Bean's is more joyous, definitely.
All right, here's Carl Bean. This song also, and I'm wondering why this was the case, you write, straight promoters told Motown that the record had no place in their clubs. Radio stations gave that song the cold shoulder, and the single once again hit a glass ceiling.
It was just too early, you know, the kind of that gay identity in pop didn't really become, you know, mainstream until the early 80s, when you had sort of out gay pop acts. Even, you know, the 70s, this is when Elton John was in the closet. This was when Freddie Mercury was in the closet. You just didn't do this. And what's amazing about this record is it was written by a straight woman, straight church-going woman. And she saw no problem with it. And she thought, well, if I'm a straight church-going black woman and I can write this gay anthem, then surely it will, you know, cross over and other people will see that what I'm saying is not controversial or difficult. Plus, it's a great song. And sometimes that is the problem that certain protest songs face, is that they're slightly ahead of the curve.
An email has come in from Terry. Do you have any plans to release a protest song collection as a CD to accompany the book? That's a good idea.
Well, unfortunately, with the state of sort of the record industry and compilation sales, I'm told that it's not particularly viable, which is a shame, because it's something that, you know, that I'd have wanted to do very early on. Not even necessarily the 33 songs, many of which people know, but to introduce people to, you know, hundreds of songs that I hadn't heard before, more obscure ones, you know, follow-up singles from artists that we know well. There's a whole kind of underground of really great protest records, which I would put out if I could.
And what about protest songs now? Have they, we were looking at eras, Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, certainly the music of the civil rights era and anti-Vietnam songs. What's happened to all of that? There aren't as many, are there?
I'm not sure if it's a question of volume as so much as impact. You know, that there were definitely periods when certain records were so big that you would just assume there were hundreds like them. You know, the power of one blowing in the wind, for example, is sort of incalculable, and that matters much more than 100 diverse records that don't get on the radio. So what we have now are lots and lots of people putting out political songs, you know, that mainstream artists that have political records, underground artists that are, you know, definitely avowedly political, but they're not getting, you know, apart from Lady Gaga's song, actually, they're not getting the airplay, they're not getting the recognition, they're not getting the movement behind them. You know, there needs to be this enormous appetite from the public for, you know, songs about social change. And for whatever reason, you know, whether that be the kind of diversity of music now and the way people consume it in so many different ways, or a general skepticism towards, you know, pop stars who have political views, it's very hard for them to kind of punch through and really become undeniable in the way that, I mean, Green Day's American Idiot was an example of a song which was huge and quite risky and undeniable. But now you just have to look around more. But what interests me about what's been happening this year in North Africa, in protests in London, in Wisconsin, of course, is that there is a need in certain quarters, and that people are reaching for songs. And so, you know, in Wisconsin, you had people like Tom Morello coming and performing Woody Guthrie songs, performing old Union ballads.
Mm-hmm.
You had people writing new songs for that occasion. And that kind of reminds me that where there is a sense of injustice, where there's a sense of needing to, you know, to kind of stiffen your morale and bond people to you and make your voice heard, that this is a basic need. And that need is not going to go away, even if we're not likely to see a figure as powerful as, you know, Dylan in 63, or The Clash in the late 70s, or Public Enemy in the late 80s. So you have to look a little bit harder and in certain places to find them now.
You mentioned the big song by Green Day, American Idiot. Let's play a little bit of this and talk about that group.
Information age of hysteria is calling out to idiot America.
Tell me about the formation of Green Day.
Well, they came out of an incredibly politicized scene in Berkeley and Oakland in the late 80s with this club run by a guy called Tim Yohannan, who was the most, adamantly far left-wing figure in U.S. punk. So they kind of were weaned on these ideas when they were like 15. This was an important thing to do. And then during the 90s, as they became big and they didn't write political songs and they were sort of derided as sellouts, and they moved into a different phase. And here what was happening was that they were, because of Bush and because of the Iraq War, they were becoming more and more bothered, and they were kind of reaching back to that feeling that they'd had in the clubs in the 80s, and just trying to see that if they could take those kinds of messages and instead of playing in some tiny club in Berkeley, make them huge, make them kind of stadium worthy. And with that record, it worked, and it could easily have not. You know, that album could have been seen as like the flop one where they went political and nobody was interested. And instead it just caught on, and that's when things can be inspiring. Is when you get the timing right. That came out around the 2004 election, when there were enough people there who would take it to their hearts. Whereas when the Dixie Chicks made their controversial statement about Bush in March 2003, they were crucified in the press.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really is a reminder that so much of it is about timing. And when you write a song, you don't necessarily know if you've got the timing right.
I want to play a little bit of this, which we're reminded of, and it's interesting when I heard this again after he died just a couple weeks ago. I remember the impact of this, I guess you would call it a rap, from Gil Scott-Heron. Let's listen to this.
The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry Arm women liberationists and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Keyes, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, or Engelbert Humperdinck. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath.
Gil Scott-Heron certainly made a big impact when that came out. Tell us a little bit about that. Is it a rap? Would you say it's a rap?
I think that can be a bit overstated. He was one of many artists working in that kind of, performance poetry with a beat kind of thing. And I think that sometimes he's almost underrated because people say, oh, yeah, he was the forefather, a forerunner of rap. Whereas he was such an important figure at the time in terms of, his songwriting, the range of what he could say, that he could be satirical, he could be angry, he could be funny, he could be compassionate. He couldn't just, rap like that, but he could also sing. And he was always always first, it seemed. You can look at so many big issues of the 70s and 80s, and Gil Scott-Heron was invariably the first person to cover them.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed your book so much. It's just so well done and such history and completely absorbing and well written. Thank you so much for doing it, Dorian.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Dorian Lynskey, the book is 33 Revolutions Per Minute, A History of Protest Songs from Billie Holiday to Green Day. We wanted to end this show because it shows how some ideas come to fruition many years later. He starts the book this way, Midnight Chicago's Grant Park, November 2008, with Barack Obama telling supporters it's been a long time coming, but tonight, because of what we did on this day in this election at this defining moment, change has come to America. A paraphrase, Dorian reminds us, of words written by Sam Cooke almost 45 years previously. I know a change going to come at this historic moment. He writes, one of the greatest orators of the day has borrowed the most memorable line of his acceptance speech from an old protest song. Obama, in a sense, is the first protest song president. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program.
Oh, yes, it will. It's been too die.